I knew he'd screw it up.
I did.
My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ray.
I've been asked to come here and talk to you about the steps because I've been an alcoholic anonymous a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time. And I've done this before, and I usually enter these disclaimers before I start. I'm not here to teach you anything. We don't need any teachers around here. I'm not here to preach to you, or I probably will. That's the way I am. I lapse into it. What I'm here to do is what was read earlier this morning, and that is to share my experience with you. And I have been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous since November the 24th, 1965. And I came to AA earlier in 63, but I didn't stay. I came back in 65, and I'm something of a snob, and I said to my sponsor when I came back, I didn't want to make an issue out of this. I didn't want to raise the thing or anything, cause trouble. But there were several people in my home group that probably had not gone to college. I didn't want to start, you know, I don't know. I don't want to be that way. But I said to my sponsor, how many nights a week do I have to hang out with this crowd? And he said, 7. I said, God, that's every day. He said, you're getting better already. I don't like people to push me around, so I went to 9. And now I go to 7, 33 years later. So I've been to a lot of AA meetings. And unless I'm in a hospital or out of town somewhere, I go to AA meetings. And I have a home group. I have a sponsor. This is what counts. Today, what is happening here and what was happening here last night, this is the icing on the cake. AA is you and your sponsor and your group. That's AA. This is fun. For me, this is terrific. You know, it's more ego-bending than even I can describe. So that's what I share with you. I share my experience, and it's considerable. Before I get into the steps, I usually talk about a history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is not the history that starts at Akron, Ohio. This history ends at Akron, Ohio. And it's a very good story. I tell it well. And it raises to me a very interesting point. I don't know when the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous started. Things like Alcoholics Anonymous, fellowships, organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous, I think have a... Oh, I warn you, I have lots of opinions. I usually say, I think, then you know it's an opinion. So I think our starter in some other plane at some other time and lost in the continuum. And so I don't know when the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous started. It was needed in biblical times. But anyhow, I tell you what I do know. In this country, in this century, before the first war, which began in 1917, a group of people began to assemble in a little town in Manchester, Vermont. It's a very small town. It's a resort town. Beautiful place. It's in the foothills of the Green Mountains. It has its own little mountain called Equinox. And these people began to come there, and they didn't know each other. They just began to sort of show up. These coincidences we see all the time in AA. The first one that came there was Bill Wilson. He came to go to the prep school. There was a prep school there, Manchester Prep. He came down from East Dorset, Vermont, which is about 7 miles up the road on Route 7. I went to college up there. I know the area well. The next one that came over was from Albany, New York, named Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby's family had a big house on the main street of Manchester, Vermont, which is Route 7. And then up from Brooklyn, New York, came a physician named Burnham and his lovely daughter, Lois. And then from New York City came a very wealthy young man named Roland Hazard, whose family had a lot of wealth and had a gentleman's farm just north of Manchester. And they mixed the way young people do. And went off to college, came back for their vacations. Bill went to Norwich University, picked up a commission in the Vermont National Guard. And as we know from our book, he went over to Europe, to England, where he saw that poem in the graveyard and all. And they dispersed with the war, and they all came back, and they spent another summer together after the war. Bill had married Lois before he went overseas, and the others just drifted away the way, you know, you drifted away from your high school friends, your college friends. And the first one to get into trouble with whiskey was Mr. Hazard, Roland Hazard. Roland's family had sent him everywhere there was, and they had enough money to do it. But he was drunk. And so they sent him finally to the great Dr. Jung, Carl Jung, in Switzerland, and he stayed with Dr. Jung a whole year. And Jung was treating him as sort of a manic depressive. And he turned him loose and told him he was all settled now, he should go home and have a nice life. Roland got as far as Paris, and someone asked him the wrong question. Someone asked him if he'd like to have a drink, and the only time I ever said no to that question, I completely misunderstood the question. So he had several million drinks, and he went right back to Jung, as you would do. And he said, what is this? I'm here a whole year. You tell me I'm well, now I'm worse than ever. I've only been 2 weeks away. And Jung said to him, and it's in our book, he said, I didn't know you were an alcoholic. I really was treating you as a manic depressive. But now that you tell me you're an alcoholic, Jung said, I have very bad news for you. You will die. First you will go mad, then you will die. And of course, Roland Hazard said, my God, is there no other way? And the great Jung said to him, oh yes, here and there, now and then, once in a while, people like you have a religious transformation, and it accomplishes a change in them, a transference, and they don't drink anymore. But it's very, very, very rare. It's a phenomenon. It hardly ever happens. It's nice to have money, real money. So Roland went off to buy himself a spiritual experience. It was either that or die. And he found the Oxford group. And the Oxford group were a bunch founded by a really charismatic man who got into a little trouble later named Buckman, and they considered themselves to be first century Christians. That is to say, they tried to live as Christians did in the first 100 years after the death of Christ and before the growth of an institutional church, before there were bishops and cardinals and all that stuff. And they lived, they had meetings like we have, or we copied their meetings, really. They were very big on openly confessing their faults and making amends for harms they had done. They practiced the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. And they tried to be absolutely all of those things. And Roland found them in the Calvary Episcopal Church in New York City on the east side. In the 30s, if you go there, it's around Gramercy Park, you know, New York, you'll see the main window of that church is dedicated to the Hazard family. And it was a very big operation in the 30s. And now they had an office building. They had a hospice for battered women back in the 30s, imagine. They had a soup kitchen because the depression was on. I've been out there. You know what's out there? Terror is out there. Terror, I'm not talking about fear. I'll tell you about alcoholism. And he took the Oxford groupers. Now remember, this is the Great Depression. Most of you don't remember that. In this country, all at once, at the same time, the stock market failed, the banks closed. Imagine you went to your bank, it was closed. Well, the banks closed. There were people who had no money, no food. They weren't alcoholics. The whole country was that way. And Roland took 30-some-odd Oxford groupers up to Vermont to the farm. And he made an Oxford group commune up there. And he paid for everything. So he's a very nice guy to have around during the Great Depression. And the next one to get in trouble was Emmy Thatcher. Emmy's family had exiled him from Albany, New York. It's a terrible place to be exiled from. It's the capital of New York State. It's on a dead line about 60 miles west of Manchester. So he came over, and the first thing he did was drive his car around one of those Vermont corners, and he ended up in the kitchen of some farmer. Vermonters are not notorious for their humor, and nobody thought anything funny about Ebby, especially when he got out of the car and asked for a drink. That did it. And so they called the cops, and the cops took him. Cops took him to the local judge, and the local judge gave him that "if I ever see you again" speech. I used to be a judge. I know how to give that speech. And Emmy, in a fit of alcoholic remorse that you will understand, decided that he would paint the family house. It's one of these big Victorian things with spires and porches and stuff. And of course, he knew nothing about painting, but that doesn't stop an alcoholic, for God's sake. So he got some paint, he got a brush, and he started painting the house. But he kept falling off the ladder because he was drunk. And so he decided he would enjoy his handiwork for a moment or two. And he got out a bottle of booze and a beach chair. And he parked himself on the front lawn. And while he was watching the paint dry and drinking this booze, a bird shat upon the paint. And this so enraged Brother Ebby that he went in and he got a shotgun. So now you have this bum in a beach chair with a bottle of booze and a shotgun, and he's shooting birds on the main street. So here come the cops. It's the same cops. They only have 3 cops in the whole town. And they bring him to the same judge, and the same judge is ready to... Well, this judge had heard of the United States Constitution, and news had filtered through to Vermont. And so he gave him his one phone call. And, of course, who would you call? He called his pal Roland, the one with the money. And Roland came down with 2 other guys from the Oxford group. One of them was the judge's drunken son that had stopped drinking up with Roland on the farm. And Roland said to the judge, "You give me Ebby, I'll take care of him like I took care of your son." The judge said, "My pleasure." Now they're all up on the farm, and it's getting cold up there. So Roland and Ebby pack it into New York, back to the Episcopal Church, and they get on the soup line, and they're handing out the stuff. And in those days, you got a bowl of soup, a sandwich, and an apple. We had one in my parish recently. So Ebby testifies. He says he was on the soup line, and a thought came to him. I better call Bill Wilson. He doesn't know where this thought came from. But he said it was very strong. He kept saying, "Call Bill Wilson, call Bill Wilson." Bill Wilson says in our book, the phone rang. Bill is at home. Lois is working. Bill is unemployable and unemployed. And he's making gin in the bathtub. In the 30s, they used to do that. They clean out the bathtub, throw in some water, some distilled water, juniper berries, and rubbing alcohol. Boom, gin. And Bill has got 3 quarts of this crap that he's ready for the day. And the phone rings, and it's his pal. He said, his schoolmate. And he said to his schoolmate, "Come on out, see me." So Ebby comes out, and Bill takes a look at Ebby as he comes in the house, and there's something different about him. And he says to Ebby, "What got into you?" And Ebby said, "I got religion." Bill says, "I was aghast. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot, and now a little cracked about religion." He had that starry-eyed look. But more gin for Bill. So they go into the kitchen and they start to, I don't want to be indelicate, the barroom bullshit. And remember the time, you know. And in our book, they said they talk about the airplane ride. Bill and Ebby were the first ones to land an airplane at the Manchester airport They flew over from Albany all drunk, and the pilot was drunk. And the reason they were the first ones was it hadn't opened yet. It was going to open the next day. And when they landed the plane, the high school band was practicing for the opening the next day, and these three drunks fell out of the airplane and reviewed the troops as they went by, you know. Well, that's what they were going to do. You remember that. You're going to sit around the kitchen table, say, I remember the time, all of that stuff. But Ebbe, you see, was now a member of the Oxford. And Ebbe was full of that enthusiasm, the same enthusiasm you had in your first 6 months or a year and a half in AA. You remember you're going to call up your cousin Charlie and straighten him out, you know, oh, Charlie, you're ruining your life, that kind of stuff. And some guy you went to high school with, I better call him right away. Well, Ebbe was full of that, but he was full of Oxford group. And he starts giving Bill Oxford, and Bill doesn't want to hear about Oxford. Bill is a born Episcopalian, or God's frozen people. But he was never interested in much. He didn't like religion. He never bothered with it. He paid more attention to his grandfather, who was a little on the wifty side. And finally, Ebbe said something that really got Bill's attention. Ebbe said, in the Oxford group, you can form your own concept of God. Boom. That got Bill's attention. He did not stop drinking. But there is a religious anarchy. You form your own concept of God. Imagine if the Pope said tomorrow, now listen, gang, you know, we've been at the millennium's coming. You're on your own. Form your own concept. Whatever you say is okay with us. Best regards, the Pope, you know. You can't have that. You can't have a religion, but this is so. Now, Bill did not stop drinking. He didn't stop drinking, but it got his attention, and he put it in the book in italics. He put it in italics for the book. He said, and it's italics means underlined, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more that was required for me to make my beginning. Bill stops drinking. Finally, on December the 11th, that's his sobriety date, 1934, Bill goes into Towns Hospital in New York City. It was a double brownstone, Central Park West. Been there for a while. Bill had been there. The Grapevine printed his admissions sheet about 6 or 7 years ago, and I keep forgetting which number. But he was an experienced, he might have been there 7 times before, I'm not sure. But he was an experienced patient. And he went there. And he writes in our book, you'll find I refer to the book a lot, my schoolmate visited me. Ebbe came to see him. Ebbe gave me some more Oxford group. He said, we made a list of people I'd hurt toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my willingness to approach these individuals. I was to test my thinking by new God consciousness within. My friend, Ebbe, promised me that when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Now, here's the point of this. Ebbe never told Bill that he would stop drinking. You know why? Here's why. Because drinking is not, was not the problem, ever, for you or for me. Nobody had to teach you how to drink. You had to read a manual, how to drink, how to behave socially while drinking. It's in the bone, for Christ's sake. He told him he would enter into a new, it would have to be new, it would have to be new relationship with God, because you and I didn't have a relationship with God when we got here. Correct? Correct. He didn't say a word to him about drinking, and I'll tell you why. Because drinking alcohol does not cause alcoholism. On the occasion of AA's 50th birthday in 1960, Bill Wilson wrote a letter to Carl Jung, the great Carl Jung, who had taken care of Roland Hazard, and he said, Dr. Jung, We of Alcoholics Anonymous consider you to be a founder because in 1934, you gave a message to a man named Roland Hazard, who gave it to Ebbie Thatcher, who gave it to Bill Wilson, who gave it to Bob Spivey. And he got back a marvelous letter from Young that I refer to all the time. And it says, I remember Roland Hazard. His problem was that he had separated himself from the whole, W-H-O-L-E. In medieval terms, a union with God. Now here's the greatest psychiatrist of the time, says alcoholism is caused by a separation from God. And I heard read here this morning that God has all power. It says that. And if I separate myself from all power, I am powerless. And that's why Ebbie said to Bill, you will enter into a relationship with God, because that what was lacking in Bill and in me. I don't see, and I'm not religious. Don't misunderstand me. I don't go to church. I've been in church for 50 years. I go to funerals. I go to weddings. I prefer the funerals. They're final, you know. That's it. That's over with, you know. Wedding, I got to come back to another goddamn chafing dish 5 years later, you know. Now what? Now, that's what, that was Jung's great opinion about. And the reason is, it's true. Alcohol does not cause alcoholism. I'm talking to you now about the first step. Alcohol does not cause alcoholism. As a matter of fact, as Dr. Silkwood says in our book, my natural state is to be nervous, irritable, and discontent. A friend of mine, a physician in Louisville, been a member of AA for many years, he puts it this way. I think this is the simplest way I've heard of it. He said, alcoholics are born not feeling good. Oh, they're not sick. They don't have to go anywhere, and you don't have to give them anything. They just don't feel good. It's a goddamn hassle. They're in the wrong family. They get the wrong crap to wear. Their brother gets the good stuff at Christmas. The school is a pain in the ass. Nobody likes them. And then when they're about 13 or so, 13, you know, in there, somebody puts a glass in their hand and says, here, try that. And they drink it and they go, ooh. Give me another one of those. And they have another one. And they go, oh, what the hell is that? And they have another one. You know what? And they say, oh, I feel good. 13 is the first time in his life he's felt good. Why wouldn't you and I pursue that? It's a euphemism, isn't it? We're feeling good. Some guy's laying on the floor, the puke is coming out. What's the matter with him? He feels good. He's feeling good. Dr. Menninger, the seminal American psychiatrist, has a multi-volume work. He has alcoholism in the chapter on suicide. And he says of alcoholics that alcohol is the glue that holds them together. And if it weren't for the alcohol, they'd be jumping out of the windows. They feel so bad without it, so apart, so disconnected. And they know if they, as our book says, they cannot imagine life with it or without it. And that's when the despair hits and boom, out they go. The alcoholics who kill themselves are not drinking. That's accidental. That's automobiles and stuff like that. They're the ones who come here, leave, and can't come back. They keep trying to come back. You met them. But they can't come back. They can't come back. Kind of figure out how what it makes your mouth with it. Now, this is where they place these psychiatrists who are knowledgeable. There's a separation from God. And our book says that alcohol, the problem, it says, centers in the mind. Now, the mind is not the brain. The brain is an organ that sits on top of your head here, gelatin, split in half. They suck out the piano lessons. When they want to look at it, they can look at it. They can x-ray it. They can chart it. They know which part of it does what. It's an organ, just like your hands, your eyes, your nose. The mind is not capable of any of that. The mind is a spiritual thing. The mind is the medical equivalent of the soul. See? And the problem centers in the mind. And Jung, in his letter to Bill Wilson, makes a pun in Latin. And to show you I'm erudite and a graduate of the Catholic schools, where else would a guy named O'Keefe go to school? I'm very grateful. I don't knock the Catholic school system or the nuns or anything. I'm very grateful to the Catholic schools. They saved me from going blind. That's a big... It took a little while for you to get that, didn't it? These are all my little jokes, you know. And he said, Jung said, at the very last line of his letter to Bill, he said, it is spiritus contra spiritum. You see, in Latin, the same word expresses alcohol, wines and spirits, spiritus, against, contra, against spiritum, the soul. Jung recognized that alcohol attacked our spirit. And that's why we're powerless. And it isn't a question of drinking more, drinking less, doing this, doing that, going here, going there. The dilemma that refers in our book is not that we drink too much. The dilemma is we don't have the capacity to drink at all. It says lack of power. See, that's our dilemma. And now here's Wilson. And he's in towns. And then we promised him a new relationship with his creator. He said, I fully accepted these proposals. And then Ebby leaves him. And Bill, who's a big, tall, lanky, 6'4" guy, throws himself on one of those little 1930 hospital beds. And for someone like him, he does something very unusual because he has reached his alcoholic bottom, as you did. And you don't need a sermon from me to explain to you how you felt when that happened to you. Do this with me right now. Go back to the last week that you drank before you came here. You got it. Now go back to last week. Make the difference. Is there a difference? Huh? What do you say? Bet your ass you say thank you. Well, Bill was in that, see? Bill was in that week before, that last day. And now he's on his knees. Now, here's a guy that doesn't go to church, doesn't believe, da, da, da. And he says, if there is God, let him show himself now. And Bill reports that his room lit up with a light so intense that he could no longer see the walls, and that in his mind's eye, a wind blew through that room and transported him into a fourth dimension. And in his mind's eye, he thought to himself, so this is the God of the preachers, because he didn't believe. He was not a believer. And of course it subsided, and he sent for Silkworth, and then Silkworth came, and Bill wanted the explanation, and then Silkworth, who's a scientist, said, I wasn't here. I don't know what happened to you, but you look better now than you did a few hours ago, so try to hold on to whatever happened to you. Bill comes out of the hospital the next week or so, and he goes right down with Ebby and Roland on the soup kitchen. and they're handing out the soup. And Bill is trying to interest, some of the people coming through the line are alcoholics. Bill's trying to interest them in his problem and in his, what happened to him. And he's getting no place. He's going into the saloons. You know, New York, there's a bar in every corner. He's going into the bars. He wants them to listen to him about his room lit up. People in New York City have a certain attitude. I was born in the Bronx, and I have that attitude. If some lanky dip comes walking in while you're drinking and tries to tell you his room lit up, you know, and jump up here and light this up, Charlie, you know. I got something lit for you, pal. Take a hike for yourself. Well, he got upset. He went up to Silkwood. And he said, listen to what is happening. I'm telling these idiots my room lit up. God was in my room. They won't listen to me. And Silkwood said, you're telling them the wrong thing. Tell them what Jung told Roland, what I told you and I told your wife, you're going to die. That gets people's attention. Tell them he's going to die. So now Bill goes to Akron, Ohio. Now it gets interesting. Now it really gets interesting. He gets Akron, Ohio. It's Mother's Day of 1935, Mother's Day weekend, which is, I think, the second week of May. It's Saturday of the Mother's Day weekend. He's got $10. His room is paid for. Everybody else had went back to New York to be home for Mother's Day. Bill doesn't have enough money to go back to New York. He's stuck in Akron, which is a real crap hole. Believe me, it's nothing. And he's in this Mayflower Hotel. And he's thinking about going into a bar. In fact, it was a gay bar. Our book says, he could hear that gay crowd inside. That's what it said. And he said he would strike up a conversation. Us beloved, here's a guy, listen to this. Here's someone who has, this is alcoholic, has God, Almighty God, in his room in December, and he wants to go into a bar in May. Now, what in the name of God is that but alcoholism? Weird, huh? Weird. But he does it. He makes a series of phone calls, and he gets Henrietta Seibling. Here's where it really gets good. This is where it goes. I'm an old trial lawyer. And trial judge, if I had to convince somebody, a jury or something, this is where I would hang this case. Henrietta Seibling is the estranged daughter-in-law of Frank Seibling Jr., an alcoholic, whose father, Frank Seibling Sr., is chairman of the board of Goodyear Rubber. Only recently I saw on cable TV Castles in America. They had the Seibling Castle. And they had the guest house where Henrietta lived. No, the guest house. He'd take my house, put her in there 10 times. And he gets Henrietta on the phone. And he says, I am a rummy from New York City, and I have a way to fix drunks. Henrietta is a member of the Oxford Group of Akron, Ohio. Under the practice of the Oxford Group of Akron, Ohio, the members of the group, on the first meeting of a month, openly confess their problems. In the first meeting of May, Dr. Robert Smith, a proctologist, we dress him up a little, we call him a surgeon. Proctologist, not a bad specialty, you're going to work with alcoholics, I'll tell you. Dr. Robert Smith stood up and said, I have a drinking problem. Well, they all knew it, but he said it. Now, the practice was, if someone confessed like that, every member of the group, and I don't know how many there were, agreed that they would pray for that member every single day. So Henrietta Seibling has been on her knees in her kitchen every day from May the 1st to May the 13th, asking God to send help for Dr. Bob. And here comes this voice. I have a way to fix drugs. Henrietta says later, She said to herself, manna from heaven. So one, and then she said, so one, she didn't say, what took you so long? You see, Henrietta was a woman of faith. Henrietta believed. She believed that if she asked God to help Bob, God would help Bob, and that's that. And she did ask God to help Bob, and he did help Bob. He sent him Bill. So she said she wanted to look Bill over to make sure he wasn't a complete screwball. So she said, come on out. So Bill came out. They had a chat. She said, he's all right. She called Bob's house. She got Ann. She said, the guy is here to fix Bob. Ann says, well, that's nice, but Bob is under the table drunk. He brought home a pot for Mother's Day. He gave me the pot, and he's more potted than the pot, and he went in. But I'm out in the morning. Now, you know how Bob felt the next morning. And his wife wakes him up and says, we're going to Henrietta's. There's a guy out there who's going to fix you. Oh, Jesus. Bob says, I'll give that guy from New York 15 minutes. And the meeting lasted 5 hours. And Bill outlined to Bob what Abby had outlined to Bill, what Silkworth had talked about to Bill about. And Bob said, I'll do everything you say. And Bob said of Bill, I'm reading now from Language of the Heart, of more importance was the fact that Bill was the first human being I had ever talked to who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. See? That's what we're talking about here, experience. And this is what happened. This is their experience. See, you cannot argue with experience. I have an opinion. You can argue with my opinion. I may have an opinion the world is flat. We can have an argument. But you can't argue with my experience. And I can't argue with your experience. And nobody knows better than you what you were doing that week before you came here. And nobody knows better than you what you were doing last week. And that's your experience. And nobody can argue that with you, right? That's yours. That's yours. That's gold. And that's what Bill gave to Bob. And that's what Bob fell for. So Bill moved into Bob's house. And they had meetings in the morning. They were in the kitchen. They were reading the Bible. They were reading the book of James. And it was just the two of them and Mrs. Bob. And then Bob announces that he has to go to Atlantic City to the American Medical Association conference. You know those, did you ever have that? It seemed like a good idea at the time. You remember those? Oh, Jesus, what am I doing here? You know, oh, God. Well, it must have been a good idea at the time, because here I am. Anyhow, that's what Bill says. I'm going to Akron. And his wife, you can't go to Atlantic City. You get drunk. Every time you go to that convention, you get drunk. Sounded like my wife. And Bill said, that's not a very good idea. So Bob was, he was drunk before he left Akron. And he came back from the convention, drunk, drunker, drunkest. Got into a fight in a bar. Our beloved co-sponsor gets into a fight in a bar. He's rescued by his nurse's husband, takes him home, throws him on the couch, calls up the house, gets Bill, says, I got him. Bill said, I'll be out in the morning. Bill went out in the morning with Bob's car. I took him to the hospital, gave him some phenobarbital, a couple of bottles of beer, and Bob went up to work on some guy's ass. And if you may pardon the medical expression. And now it's 5 o'clock at night, and they're home, and there's no Bob, and now they know he's drunk, and now it's 6 o'clock, and there's no Bob, and they know he's drunk, and now it's midnight, and in walks Bob, and he's not drunk. And where have you been? He said, I've been driving around in my old Buick, mending fences, an old Vermont expression. You see, when Bob had that first conversation with Bill, he said to Bill, I'll do everything you say, but I can't make those amends. This is a small town. I'm the last string of my practice. I've been barred from one hospital. I'm close at the other. I can't be driving around telling people I harm them because it's no good. It'll ruin me. Bill took what he could. Then Bob got drunk. Now it's his first day of not getting drunk. What had he been doing? Making amends. in our book, as a result of that, this book is a book of experience. This is a book of experience. And I will give you an opinion of mine based on this. Bill Wilson was 3 years sober when he wrote this book. When I was 3 years sober, I could just about get to the goddamn meetings. I couldn't write no book, and I'm as smart as he was ever. I think Bill had a little help in writing this book. I don't want to push the thought, but I think he had some help. Because there's stuff in this book that's way beyond Bill. And he puts in here, as a result of that, and I heard it read, at some of these steps, we balked. Bob balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. And that's what we're talking about here in these early steps. We're at the turning point, you and I. Well, boy, if we had taken the other turn. I'll tell you about my brother. I had a brother, Billy, who was 4 years older than I. I was born in the South Bronx in New York City. I had no father. I had an alcoholic mother. And I had my brother, Billy, who was 4 years old, and I had two very wonderful sisters. And Billy was a big alcoholic, big-time alcoholic, and I learned to drink with Billy. I learned everything with Billy. He was my father, my hero, my brother. And when I was 5 years sober, Billy came to see me. He lived on the street. He was an alcoholic. I'd spent a long time in the Marines, and he had a check, and he lived down the Bowery, and he'd come up when he felt like it. And he was up, and I was going to a meeting, and I asked him if he'd like to go with me, and he said, no. He said, I'm not an alcoholic. I just like to drink. He said, you're an alcoholic. You've always been weird. And, you know, that's all right with me. And when I came back that night to the meeting, he was gone. He had taken some money from my wife. Had given him some money, and he just disappeared. And 5 years later, they called me up from the Veterans Hospital, and they said he was dead. He died of alcoholism. It killed him. He didn't even have it. He didn't have it. He told me he didn't have it. And he died hurt. He died the way alcoholics do. Without family, without friends. Just a terrible thing. But I'll tell you this. I'll tell you this. My brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. He stopped the hard way. He doesn't drink anymore. And Bill was back here in Akron, and Bob wasn't drinking, and they all stayed together. And then Bill came back to New York, and the thing started to go. And as many years ago, and many lives ago, and many people have come here, many people have left here. And here you and I are in Orlando in 1999, in the month of January. It's a long way from Akron, Ohio, isn't it? And I'm not talking to you about geography. It's a long way from Akron, Ohio. And what was the first thing they did? The first thing they did was to get together. Bill Wilson needed Bob Smith as much as Bob Smith needed Bill Wilson, if not more. Can you give me one of those napkins over there? Bill Wilson needed Bob Smith as much as Bob Smith needed Bill Wilson. Thank you. Bill Wilson never could stay sober until he met Ebby at the hospital. Stay sober. Ebby never did stay sober, as I use that term. He got periods of sobriety, periods of dryness, but Bill put him away, Ebby, in the last 6 years of his life. Bill paid for him. He was had him in some dump up there in Albany, and they buried him up there. But he never got sober, which brings up another point. The quality of the message is not dependent upon the quality of the messenger. So if something I say you don't like or offends you, don't worry about it. but listen to the message. Because the message I'm bringing you is the same message that this book brings you. And that's the first word, the first step, and they need it. And you and I, that's why we're here, we. And it isn't a question of drinking, not drinking at all, as I explained before. It's a question of powerless. Powerless. And it took me, thank you, it took me 3 years. I came in 62, it took me 3 years to get a year. I fought this thing, I fought it. It wasn't going to get me, son of a bitch. And I went at this. I shook my finger at it, you know. And I knew a lot about alcoholism. I knew a lot about it. I knew it as a practical thing. I'm the only male member of my family to reach age 50. All of the O'Keefes are dead, the men. All died of alcohol. And I knew it. I went to the funerals. I used to make a joke out of it. I said, doesn't he look good now? We stopped drinking. And we thought that was funny. And then we go across the street to a bar and we talk about how the deceased drank too much. I knew about it. And I'm a very smart guy. And a very strong-willed man. And as I told you, I was born with absolutely nothing. I had zero going for me, and when I was 26 years old, I was a professor of law at Fordham University School of Law. When I was 29 years old, I was the youngest tenured professor of law in the United States. And when I was 35 years old, I was asked to resign for drinking. So smart doesn't have much to do with it, yeah? And here's what happened to me. I was back here about 3 months in 1965, and now it's 1966. And boy, did I want to drink. Oh, Jesus, did I want to drink. Every day I wanted to. You know, when you come the first time, you get an influx of spiritual power. You get that free ride, and you get that pink cloud, and oh, brother, it's terrific. But you got to come up off that lead. That doesn't last. You know, it's good for about 10 months, and then it sort of dips. And that's the point where you got to come up off of that like that and do something, usually the fourth step. But when you come back the second time, it's not like that. If you've had the experience, boy, every day you're hanging on there by your fingernails. You know, it's one son of a bitch. It really is. And that's why I felt. And I was afraid to drink. I was scared to drink. I was afraid. I knew what happened when I drank. Meantime, I have a wife, I have 7 children, and we're all gathered together in this. I had acquired a lot of stuff. I'd lost a lot of it, but I had kept a bunch of it. And I'm the only one that's trying to get sober in the house, and boy, oh boy, that's my wife, I'm not here. Just left. And I wake up one morning and I had no longer teaching. I still had a license to practice law. I was a pretty good lawyer and I had a law firm and all the rest of it. So I started a law business. So I get dressed and, you know, my son Jimmy says, got into my lawyer costume and go. I went to Manhattan. I lived in a village called Larchmont, New York, and I went into Manhattan. To my office, and I sat down at my desk and I looked out the window, and then it occurred to me, I had not thought of a drink that morning. The morning before, I would have killed you for a drink if I thought I could get away with it. But I was afraid to have it. And I go through Grand Central, get to my office, it's all bars, nothing but saloons all through there. And I called up my sponsor. I said, John, I didn't think of a drink today. He said, congratulations, hung up the phone. We were very close. He wanted me to whine to him and talk to me about it. We had great chats about my inner Chung Al. Yeah, but you get in touch with my emotions, which is always nice. And I started to think about this. And that's the one thing my sponsor told me not to do. You would have liked my sponsor. I'd say to him, I don't feel good. He'd say, this will be as good as you'll ever feel. Oh, Christ. I said, well, I'm very, very nervous. What do you think I should do? He said, hold on. I said, well, how do you hold on? He'd say, let go. It was like dealing with a Zen master, you know. It was all bubbles and air and baloney, you know, Christ. Then I started to think. He told me, he said, don't. I would say, I think. He'd say, don't do that. No, you will hurt yourself. So you give yourself a spiritual hernia if you do that. I said, well, I think. And then I started to think. You know, I got a good mind. I started to think, let's see. What the hell? I don't want to drink today. It wasn't that I gave it up. It wasn't that I swore off. It didn't register. It was like American cheese. It didn't count. And I said, what the hell? I live in the same place. I hang out with this, my wife, my children are the same. The next door guy, the neighbor's the same. The train's the same. This office has been here. There's only one thing different. I go to that meeting every night. That's it. I go to the meeting every night. There's something in that meeting that takes people like me who want to drink all the time and turns them around so they don't want to drink at all. Holy shit. So I went to the meeting that night and I said to Al, there's power in this meeting. He said, yeah, just sit down, drink your coffee. Yeah. I was telling Tom in the car this morning, my wife was a very, very nice lady. And the mother of all those children begged me to stop drinking. Please, she would say, you gotta do something. I told her I would, but, you know, I couldn't. My boss, he was a godfather of one of my children, the dean of the law school, went on to be a big federal judge. We had a very close relationship one time. He said, I can't have you around here like this. Said I would, but I couldn't. I was taken to my first meeting by the guy who delivered the mail to my house, Al. He was our mailman. And after the meeting, Al said to me, I'll pick you up tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And I said, that'll be fine, Al. And I haven't had a drink since. Now you tell me what the hell that is. Do you think there's something going on in the post office that we don't know about? What the hell is that? People for whom I have affection, you know, love, my boss, money. I couldn't do it for love. I couldn't do it for money. I did it for the postal service. What? You know? I've long since given up thinking about these things. But Al that night said, yeah, just sit down and have some coffee. You'll be fine. And then I figured out, so my sponsor showed up, of course, and I said to him, John, I'm reading the steps. Are they here? Some AA groups actually have the steps. Make believe they're behind me, yeah? Because I do this, I'm used to pointing. And John showed up, and I said, John, what is a power greater than my own? It's a little vague. He said, a power greater than your own is a power greater than your own. It's like dealing with Moses. You remember Moses. Moses one day was having a conversation with the bush that was on fire, you remember? What are you laughing about? Moses was talking to this thing, and naturally Moses said to this, who are you? And this thing that was on fire said to Moses, I am that I am. And Moses said, thank you for clearing that up. For a few moments there, I thought I was talking to a bush that was on fire. He said, there's a power greater than your own. He said, there's a God. He said, if you want it to be, it is. It's a power greater than our own. He said they spoke the English language. If they wanted to write God, they could say we all believe in God. But they didn't all believe in God. That wasn't true. One third of them didn't believe in God at all. Of the first, we are 100 or so men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body to show you precisely how we have recovered is the object of this book. You have recovered the debate, you know. For your information, I'm sure you know this anyhow, recovered is in the book 57 times. Recovery is in the book once. And recovering is in the book nuts. We have a guy in Miami, Donnie, who's got 40 years sober, and Donnie went to about the fourth grade, and he's a very good AA member, and he has a little trouble with the English language. And when he wants to say semantics, he says symmetrics. And when you start this with Donnie, he says, yeah, it's all symmetrics. Yeah, forget about that shit. Let's get on with it. And he's right. Precisely how they have recovered is the object of this book. It's a book of experience. And the truth of the matter is this. Why do I have to know or describe to you a power greater than your own? Why do I have to do that? What do I have to do? Describe what it looks like, put a dress on it, hang it on the wall, build a church around it? That's not what I'm talking to you about. I'm not talking to you about that. I'm not talking to you about religion. I'm not talking about a supreme being. I am talking to you about power. And that's the dilemma. Lack of power. And look at this beautiful place here. Look at this gorgeous, gorgeous place. And look at this power that's in here. These lights and there's fans, there's microphones. Now, I'm a stranger here. I don't know whether this power is coming from an atomic pile someplace or from a turbine over there someplace. Knowing Lee and his friends, they got three gerbils out in this thing that are going around like that, making a little. But the truth of the matter is, why do I have to know that? I don't have to know the source of this power. All I have to know is where the switch is. And it's right back there. Because if I walk into this room and I want power to come into this room, all I need to know is where to turn on the switch. In AA, the switch is the meeting. The switch is the meeting. The switch turned on when Bill met Ebby. The switch turned on when Bill met Bob. The switch turned on when you and I came here this morning. And there's power in this room at this minute. Do you feel that? Sometimes I think I'm overly sensitive to it. There's power in this room at this minute. Come back here tonight. Come back here at midnight tonight. Come back here at 12 o'clock tonight. Open the door. Look at me. What do you know what you're going to see? Nothing. There won't be any power here. It's just another room in another building in another place. But right now, brother, now that power did not come here with me. I know that. But it's here. It's here. And it's the same power that came into my life in 1965. It's the same power that maintains every one of your lives. It's the same power that maintains this program. And it is nothing less than the power of God. Nothing less than the power of God. And that's all it is. And that is your experience. And that's my experience. Every one of us tried to stop drinking on our own. Couldn't do it. Every one of us went out to other powers. Couldn't do it. I heard them read this morning. It must be so. If they read it, it's right in that. It says, no human power our alcohol, I'm having a senior moment. No human power can relieve our alcoholism. No human power. No Bob, no Bill, no sponsor, no group. No human power. She begged me to stop. A power clearly greater than my own. Begged me to stop. And for whom I have great affection. Not a chance. My boss, a power greater than my own. Surely I couldn't stop. Judges before whom I appear said, don't be coming in here that way. With a stroke of a pen, they could put me out of business. I'm a very unfortunate judge, you know. The guy from the post office, that's how picking up, and I go with him. What the hell? I've long since, you know, given up about it. But that's it. I came to believe. See, it happened to me. It happened to you? Nobody had to tell me about it. It happened. I didn't want to drink anymore. So, holy Jesus, I don't want to drink anymore. And I haven't seriously thought of a drink since. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't count, it doesn't register. Oh, every once in a while I see a thing go by and say, ooh. I think more about smoking than drinking, but that's a whole other subject. Now, we're going to take a break in a minute or two. I just want to solve a few mysteries. One of the great mysteries is the third step. Because people don't realize what's going on here. Right after what they read this morning and how it works, right after the next sentence in this book, after that it says, being convinced, we are at step three. That's right after the ABCs. Being convinced. And then it says, what do we mean and what do we do? See, I hear people talking about the third step, and I'm telling you, they're beyond me. You say to the guy, you want to wear the, you know, where should we go? Should we go to the movies tonight? Oh, I don't know about that. God hasn't spoken yet. I'm 100% turned over. Oh, Jesus. Here it says, you know, earlier in the book it says, clear-cut directions will be given to you. Here, listen to this. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? First they tell you what they mean. They mean this. It says the first requirement is that you and I understand that a life based on self-will can hardly be termed a success. And that was my life, and it was based on self-will. And by material worldly standards, which are not bad standards at all, and they're the standards I go by, I had a successful life. It was so successful that I spent my 35th birthday in a mental institution. I didn't surrender. They came and got me, boy. She had them come, boy. She had them throw a net right over me and take me away. And I was put in this dump, and I was only in it a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side. And I was only in there for a matter of moments when I explained to this man who was walking around in a white coat, an obvious moron, I told him it was the occasion of my 35th birthday. And on that very day, I had attained age 35, and under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said they had two presidents in residence. And he went away and left me, dirty son of a bitch. And I had to admit to myself that that life there was really not successful. This was not it either, you know. These mistakes I make, these basic, you know, seem like a good idea at the time. When I was 16 years old, I was in trouble in the neighborhood in the Bronx. I was in trouble with my mother. I was in trouble with the brothers at school. I was in lots of trouble with lots of people. So I joined the Navy. And 6 months later, I was on a minesweeper out in the South Pacific. We were blowing up the ocean, and it was raining dead fish on my head. And I thought to myself, this is not it either. A poor career choice I've made here. I was forever making decisions like that, you know. Well, this is what it says now. I was not successful in any way at all. I was good at work, but that's, you know, that's just part of life. It was not a success. I had to have, and the reason I was not successful, I didn't have the power to be successful. I did not have the capacity to be successful. I had to get that here. And I was here for a while, and my sponsor came to me, and I was going to meetings every night, and you know, I was doing what I told you. And he said, it's time for you to make up your mind. He said, what about? He said, you have to make up your mind whether or not you're going to stay here. I said, for Christ's sake, I'm here all the time. No, no, he said, you may go out again and go back the way you were. You want to do that? I said, no. He said, you sure? I mean, what the hell are you talking about? Am I sure? That's like saying, how would you like to go back to Duluth for the weekend? Here's what alcoholism is. It's that thing that wakes you up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Remember that thing? It comes into your room and it wakes you up. And it tells you you're no good, and you're a phony, and they're going to come get you soon, and you're a rotten, dirty son of a bitch. Now, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you can argue that, I am not, sir, how dare you? But at 4 o'clock in the morning, when you're in that bed, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and this thing has got you by the throat, you can do nothing except fear, right? Terror. Absolute terror. That's alcoholism. And that's what's standing out there, right by that lake. That's what's waiting for me if I go out there. And brother, I've had enough of that. I've had enough, goddammit, enough. I've been so scared, I can't take any more of that. No more. And without help, it's too much for me. I gotta have it. And it says here, that it's an amazing thing what it says here. It has here a law of supply. Remember the words of the step. It said, we made a decision to turn our lives and our will over to the care of God as we understand Him. Now, I don't make too many pronouncements in all of this, but here's one. There's no requirement in this program that you turn over anything to anybody for any purpose. Forget it. Why would you? Because I'm giving my life to God. What a lot of bullshit that is. Why would you do that? Why would you give up your life? That's your life. You don't give up your life to anybody. It's yours. And you will. Why would you do it? And who wants it? Say, hey, God, O'Keefe wants you to have his life. Oh, brother. That piece of shit that he kept. Yeah. I guess give him my regards, you know. Oh, brother. Well, you hear people doing it. They're walking around. They're all turned over. They're giving God this. And then they take it back. Suppose he don't want to give it back. Lord, I want my will back. Fuck you. All right. They take it on Tuesday, take it back on Wednesday, ha, ha, ha. Not a chance, gang. See, it doesn't say, you know what it says? It says you ask him to have a care for you. Now, isn't that nice? That's a good thought, that he would have a care for you and for me. Good thought. You know, one of my whines always was, no one cares, nobody gives a shit. Poor old O'Keefe, you know. And here it is. He has a care for you. A care. Now, I have 7 children, and I like them all. And I care for them. I don't tell them what to do. I never did tell them what to do. I didn't tell them what schools to go to. I didn't tell him what to study, what to be. I have my oldest kid, is you probably have seen him. He's a very well-known actor. He told me he wanted to be an actor. I said, that's a stupid thing to be. He's nominated for an Academy Award. He's a very good actor. And so forth and so on. I'll talk to you later about it. But I care for him. I don't tell him what to do. I don't tell him where to live and how to do it. I don't tell him how to make movies, how to be on television programs, how to marry very famous people. I didn't tell them any of that. My kids do what they want. They're all very nice kids, and every one of them has come to AA, so that makes them special. But this is what we're saying to God as we understand him, or you understand him. Have a care for me. And he has a care for you. I find that very comforting kind of a notion, that God would have a care for us. And when he comes down to the end, it says, we were now at step 3. See, all of this is prelude to step 3. And here's where they slip step 3 to you. It's a very, very simple thing. It's a prayer. They lay it on you. It's a prayer. And I'm going to ask you to do something. You don't have to do this. This is 100% voluntary. I would propose, because I'm going to read something, we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person. I'm going to suggest that as we sit here, you and I, we'll do the third step prayer. Now I'm going to read it slowly, and I want you to repeat it after me, like I was administering an oath. Because I know many of you know it, but don't get ahead of it, because some people don't know it, and we don't want to embarrass anybody. Now, if you don't want to do this, it's perfectly all right. No one's going to ask you to leave. You don't have to do anything. In fact, if you want to leave, go out and have a cigarette, take a leak in the lake, whatever you want. Now, here we go. I'm going to read it so I don't make a mistake. I change the these and the nows because I don't talk that way. Here we go. God, I offer myself to you. To build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help.